Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Now we are doing an interview today, and today we are talking about Unrigged. How Americans are battling back to save democracy. That's the name of the book. The author is David Daley. So we have him on the line. Hello, David. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Al and Joe? Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I was just going to say, now, what encouraged you to write this book?
You know, it's a great question. I had written an earlier book about partisan gerrymandering, with a title that probably unfit for a family radio show, because a partisan gerrymandering is also unfit for partisans for a family radio show. And it was a depressing book. You know, it was really a downer, because the combination of gerrymandering and a lot of the kind of voters suppression that had followed that had turned a lot of our states, you know, deeply anti-majoritarian. And it was hard to see kind of a way out of it, with politicians sort of so safely insulated from the voters. It was hard to do anything to make a change. Even a majority of voters couldn't do that. And I would go around the country talking about the book, and there'd be rooms full of people who wanted to make change. And sometimes I felt like I had this dark cloud over my head, and I wanted to get rid of that dark cloud. And I looked around the country and just saw all of these inspiring stories of people who were not daunted by the long odds. They were pushing back against these big structural problems in our democracy, and they were building real movements, and they were nonpartisan movements, and they were coming from regular citizens, not from, you know, politicians from above. And I found it so inspiring, and just realized we didn't need another book about how democracy died. You know, bookstores were filled with those. I thought we needed to hear about the stories about Americans who were teaming up, pushing back, fighting back, and winning, and trying to, you know, paint a better future.
So what are those big structural problems in our politics that you identified that need to be pushed back against?
Really, this book started with a woman named Katie Fahey in Michigan. I was 27 years old and worked at, you know, an environmental recycling group in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And a couple days after the presidential election in 2016, she had Trump voters in her family and Bernie and Hillary voters in her family. And I think she was already kind of, you know, worried about turkey and mashed potatoes flying through the air at Thanksgiving. And she went to Facebook and she wrote, "I'd like to do something about partisan gerrymandering in Michigan. If you want to do this too, join me." And this goes viral in a really weird way. And she ends up building this movement of about 4,000 volunteers, and they go out and they collect 430,000 signatures. It's the first time in Michigan history that a constitutional amendment makes the ballot without someone hiring paid petition gatherers to go out and collect those signatures. And they put it on the ballot, and they overcome money from the Koch brothers, and they overcome money from the Chamber of Commerce in the state, the Voss family, and they win with more than 61% of the vote out there. So you got to get Democrats, Republicans, and Independents to win at that level. And I mean, partisan gerrymandering had been a huge problem in Michigan. You had had voters who would favor Democratic candidates statewide in every election out there, and yet you had this legislature that it was impossible for a majority of citizens to turn that into a majority of seats in the legislature. And what you will have in 2021 are, you know, actual citizens drawing the district lines out there. So it'll be this huge change. You know, so some of the things I chronicle in the book are these fights, you know, against partisan gerrymandering. I went up to Maine and chronicled the fight for ranked choice voting, which is where citizens, you know, get the ability to rank their top choices instead of simply choosing one person. And Maine had had this long tradition of independent candidates and third parties. They've had third party governors and U.S. senators, except it was becoming kind of a problem in that they were getting so many candidates on the ballot that folks were winning these elections with 33-34% of the vote, and we were getting, you know, an extreme candidate that was getting elected that two-thirds of voters didn't want. So they said, we can protect our tradition of independent politics if we allow people to rank their choices. Go 1-2-3, make it kind of like an instant runoff. Voters get more choice, and we end up with the person that, you know, most people actually, you know, want to have in office. And the political establishment in Maine fought this hard, Democrats and Republicans. They essentially, you know, wiped it out in the assembly after voters passed it. And voters applied something called a people's veto. And they went out and they collected signatures and did a people's veto and put it back on the ballot a second time, where it won again. So voters really, you know, forced this to happen. Went down to Florida, and Florida has the toughest laws in the country about former felons who've gotten out of prison not being allowed to win their voting rights back. And this had really disenfranchised 1.7 million people there, just 10% of the adult population in Florida. You know, folks who had served their sentences were back out paying taxes, deserve to have their voice in civic affairs back, just as it would be in 47 or 50 other states. And you had this incredible moral movement there, black and white, Democrats and Republicans. This one actually saw the Koch brothers and the ACLU teaming up, you know, Trump voters on Harleys and radical criminal justice reformers on the other hand. And they managed to win this constitutional amendment there with 64% of the vote. So, you know, a question that's about race and voting wins with almost two-thirds of the vote in a state that's going pretty red. So you were able to see this kind of moral nonpartisan movement come together around voting rights and fairness. And I think that that happened around the country in a way that ought to, you know, show us that perhaps our politics are not as polarized as we think.
Yeah, none of these victories are ever that clean, though, right? I mean, here in Florida,
yeah.
I mean, they I think it was the people passed the idea that felons would gain their rights, and then the new governor sort of did everything he could to sort of take those rights back by requiring that, yeah. You know, if they owed any money to the state for their incarceration or any court fees or anything, that they couldn't vote, which is almost like a poll tax. But it just shows you that, you know, there is an entrenched establishment who really wants to do whatever it can to maintain whatever advantage it has at any given time. And they're happy to, you know, sacrifice people's rights for that advantage.
I think that's exactly right. You know, the history of voting rights in this country is not a straight line towards progress. It is, you know, it zigs and zags. And if we had settled any of these issues, you know, we didn't settle these issues by passing the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments after the Civil War. We didn't settle these issues with the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And they didn't get settled in Florida when 64% of voters restored felon voting rights. You know, the legislature continued to sort of monkey around with this after the fact. But the courts have stood up down there, and it appears that the Citizen Amendment will be allowed to go forward. I imagine the U.S. Supreme Court will get the last word on that. But they certainly did add what appeared to be a poll tax on top of that, and Florida is one of those states that's done a lot of cash registered justice. But even in the worst case scenario there, if you held back all of those voters who couldn't, all of those citizens who could not afford to pay those fines and fees, you'd still have somewhere between 350,000 and 700,000 voters who were eligible to vote who were not a year and a half ago. So it's certainly a step and a half forward and then a half step back. And that's politics.
So what about gerrymandering? I mean, this has been an issue that's been around for a long, long time. It seems like there is no good answer to drawing congressional districts within states. I mean, there are no natural bounds. It's not like a state where, you know, it's clear that the senator represents the people within that geographic boundary of the state. Here, these are sort of unnatural boundaries that have to be redrawn potentially every 10 years, depending on the census. I mean, is there a best way to do this? And what are the problems that you think need to be avoided in the drawing of congressional districts?
There are some better ways of doing it, and I think what we also want to remember is that there are also the worst ways of doing it. And right now, America has really cornered the market on the worst ways of doing it. We allow our politicians essentially to draw these lines and to choose their own voters. And no other modern democracy in the world allows that to happen. It's the ultimate fox garden. Our collective hen house. It's a major conflict of interest. And when one party has the ability to do this on their own, you end up with wildly unfair lines in that party's favor. And voters in that state are stuck with them for a decade. And both parties have done this for as long as we've had politicians in this country, right? You can trace gerrymandering all the way back to Patrick Henry trying to keep James Madison out of the very first Congress down in Virginia. It gets its name in 1812 when the governor in Massachusetts his party draws these state senate districts around Boston in such a crazy, convoluted way that a political cartoonist thinks it looks like a salamander. His name was Elbert Gerry, so you end up with the gerrymander. But what has happened is that the technology is now so good and the data is so precise and the map-making software so sophisticated that the gerrymanders that politicians were able to draw this decade are just dramatically stronger and more difficult for voters to undo than any other gerrymanders in our history. No other mapmakers have ever had access to this level of computing power and just reams and terabytes of extraordinarily granular data about voters that they're able to use to go up and down streets and make these decisions. So I think what we have to do is start by taking the power to draw these lines away from the politicians who are running in these districts. You can establish independent commissions that do a better job of this. California has probably the gold standard of commissions. It's not perfect by any means. I mean, it's hard to get all the politics out of something that's political. But what California does is it creates a commission of 15 citizens. You have to go through a rigorous application process to get on there. You've got an equal number of Republicans, Democrats, and independents. It has to be completely transparent. They go through incredible numbers of public hearings in which they listen to citizens about which communities of interest ought to have to stay together. They draw all of the lines in public. They have to then, at the end of the process, write essays about why they made certain decisions as opposed to making other decisions. And they require a supermajority of the Republicans, Democrats, and independents on the commissions. There has to be a supermajority within each of those groups backing the map for it to move forward. So the Democrats and independents can't team up on the Republicans and cram a map down their throats, or any two groups can't do that. And so in many ways, it forces transparency, it creates consensus. In some ways, it's kind of a politics we'd like to have in this country, right? I mean, imagine that. People are assigned a problem to solve, and they have to sit in a room and listen to other experts on the process and try to solve it together and come to an agreement. So if we could come up with a transparent process that actually mimics the kinds of politics we would like in the drawing of our districts, it just seems like it would be a wonderful win.
Well, I mean, that's talking about process, but the question is,
sure,
for me, what would be about outcome? And yeah, it's if I was a sitting politician who wanted to stay in office, I mean, I would want to draw districts that kept people who vote, you know, consistently voted for me together, and then write out out of my district anyone who didn't. But that's always going to be there. I mean, you are always going to have communities that are, I guess, politically segregated in the sense that you will have, you know, Democrats living in one place, Republicans, you know, living in another. And there's not much you can do about that. So you're still sort of drawing there. So what, I mean, even if you have a transparent process, what does that process get you if you still wind up with some districts that are going to be all Republican or consistently majority Republican or vice versa, consistently Democrat? I mean, what do you think should the policy goal should be? Should we have 50-50 mixed districts? Should we have districts that are far more diverse, either politically, demographically, than they are now? I mean, what can be done, I guess, to achieve some particular goal? I mean, what is the goal? More competitive districts?
I think it's a great question, and I think it gets to the heart of a lot of this about gerrymandering. I mean, drawing districts is really a question of values. It's a question of representation and how you imagine representation to be best defined. And I think that you've mentioned several different ways that you could define representation. It could be more competitive districts. It could be districts that hold specific communities of interest together. Maybe there's an economic or a cultural interest that needs representation. Maybe it is holding specific counties together. Perhaps it's compactness or contiguity. Other folks have talked about trying to create an outcome in the state that actually mirrors the political sensibilities of the state. So, you know, in Maryland right now, for example, there are 8 districts, and Democrats have 7 of those 8 districts. But the state has a Republican governor, one of the most popular Republican governors in the country. So clearly there are plenty of Republicans in Maryland, but they hold 12.5% of the state's congressional seats. So you've got something is out of whack there. You know, it's the same thing in North Carolina, where there's a Democratic governor and Republicans control 10 of the 13 seats there. You know, Democrats drew the lines in Maryland to give themselves 88% of the seats. Republicans drew the lines in North Carolina that gave them about 80% of the seats. And when you have a fair statewide election without those lines, folks choose the other party. So there are lots and lots of ways that you can measure this and try to get a better outcome. I mean, I think we talk sometimes about geography and the big sort, Democrats, you know, in big cities, Republicans being spread out more consistently. But I think that doesn't really get in the way necessarily of drawing fair districts. You look at a place like Pennsylvania, where, you know, it's often said Pennsylvania is, you know, Philadelphia on one side, Pittsburgh on the other, and Alabama in the middle. And that was what Republicans said as they tried to defend a map that they drew in 2011 that gave Republicans 13 of 18 seats in you know, probably a bluish-purple state. And they said, well, it's just the natural geography of the state. There's no other way to do this. And when you put those maps, you know, when you had academics create more than a billion neutral maps, and all of them were less partisan than the ones that the politicians came up with, a court finally calls those districts unconstitutional, requires a new map. They bring in a neutral special master, an academic out of Stanford, who draws a map. It's more contiguous. It holds more counties together. It looks more normal. And it's also more competitive. It's a 9-9 map now. So you go, even in these states that appear to be kind of, you know, geographics and demographics might get in the way of fairness, but it's not the case. When you sit down and draw a fairer map, you can do something that actually reflects the politics of a place. And I think that that's really what you want to have. You want to be sure that a delegation reflects the real political mix of the state, and that a majority of voters always have the ability to turn that around.
Now, I guess one concern I have with this, and I'm all for not having crazy districts that are designed to advantage powerful incumbents, is that we sort of wind up thinking about process over policy, and it's sort of, well, how can we get, you know, a particular outcome between two parties, as opposed to how can we get better policy? Or how can we get policies that people want, even if these policies are terrible? So I guess I sort of see myself as somewhat as a realist when it comes to democracy, knowing that there are, you know, as good as democracy is, it's only better than the other forms of government, yeah. And it doesn't. It's a process that doesn't necessarily guarantee anything good. So we can redraw districts, but at the end of the day, if we're still getting lousy policy, then what have we really gotten?
Well, I would say that there's a connection between lousy districts and lousy politics, because what lousy districts do is you end up with these uncompetitive races. You have general elections in November that simply aren't competitive. So the only action becomes in the party primary, because it's really, really hard to get a good challenger or a well-funded challenger in a race that they know they're going to lose. So you get all the action in the party primary, and these are low turnout, you know, summer races that essentially turn out at the base of either side, and you end up with more extreme members both on the left and on the right. And you incentivize those politicians to either go to Washington or to go to state capitals and not to be willing to sit down and compromise with anybody. You elect more extreme people, and then you incentivize them to only guard their base, because the only election they have to worry about is being primaried by somebody, you know, even nuttier than they are. And so they govern in a way that is not representative of what people actually want to see. I mean, I think that there's broad agreement in the country on a lot more than we think there is. You know, I mean, even hot button issues, whether it's, you know, healthcare or immigration, or, you know, a lot of these things, there's a centrist kind of consensus way forward. And our politics doesn't reflect that. And I think a lot of that has to do with how we elect our politicians.
So what should we do going forward, given what you found in your book? I mean, there are citizen movements pushing for more democracy, fighting back against entrenched, you know, establishment interests. What's the next step?
I think we need more of that, honestly, is what we need. We have got to really be thinking about the structures of voting, because the structures of voting have been just crucial to the outcomes that we are getting. There is far too much anti-majoritarianism in our politics. I mean, right now, you've got 59 million Americans that live in a state where one or both chambers of the state legislature is controlled by the party that won fewer votes in 2018. That's one in five of us. It's too many. So if we want to get back to a better politics, we've got to be thinking about redistricting, a reform. I think that is, you know, in many ways at the heart of getting a better politics, right alongside a campaign finance and, you know, changes to money in politics. And these issues are going to be all the more important as we head towards an election in 2020 in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. We don't know what November is going to look like right now. We look around and we see primaries being postponed left and right, you know, in Ohio, for example, where the governor postpones the president.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
The primary, the day before it's scheduled to happen, a court orders it open, and then the governor and the public health department say it's not safe. Or you look at Wisconsin, which has a primary coming up April 7th, and they are still trying to do this in person, and it's they are running into a lot of problems. Imagine trying to vote in November if this is ongoing, if this flails back, and we all have to be lined up 6 feet apart from one another, and someone's wiping down the voting machines after.
So, what's the answer to this? Would you argue that the answer is just mail in ballots or something like that?
I think we've got to be doing vote by mail. We have to be looking at how we expand vote by mail. And no excuse absentee balloting in such a way that a public health crisis doesn't also blossom into a full-blown a crisis of a democracy and a constitutional crisis.
So how do you see this playing out over the next few months? I mean, do you think that more and more elections are going to be canceled, or are they going to find other platforms on which to hold the election? Or do you think, even if people have the ability to vote, they won't even care because they're too busy dealing with coronavirus stuff?
Yeah. A lot of states have moved April and May primaries to the first week of June. And what we're hearing right now is, April and May are probably going to be, shelter in place months again. I mean, are we really going to come back in June and line up at the polls? I'm not sure we are, or whether that would even be safe. So, I think we've got to be spending these 200 days thinking about how important this presidential election is and safeguarding it.
Do the primaries even matter anymore at this point? I mean, obviously Trump is going to get the Republican nod, and it looks like, I can't imagine a scenario in which Sanders would beat out Biden at this point.
Yeah, he still needs more delegates, right? That's an interesting question. What happens in do Democrats simply postpone these primaries if they can't be done safely? I don't know the answer to that. But what I know is that if this is still a problem in October and November, and we are still trying to figure out how to vote, then it's going to become, you know, a deeply passionate and partisan problem. And we can avoid that if we can, you know, settle on some vote-by-mail rules now and, you know, figure out the kind of nonpartisan ways to be sure that, you know, senior citizens in Florida are safe voting, and, you know, blue voters in New York are safe lined up, and that these problems aren't the case in, you know, purplish swing states like Ohio and Wisconsin. It's not a partisan issue. It shouldn't be. We've got to come together here and figure out how to do it. And they included $400 million in the stimulus package to, you know, think about this, which was far less than the $2 billion that election reformers said they would need to kind of put vote by mail in place. A $2 trillion package can't include a $2 billion, essentially a rounding error for a democracy, seems like a mistake.
Some states already have vote by mail, and I think all states have at least some amount of voting taking place by mail. So how much would it really cost, and what would be driving those costs to do that? I mean, you just have to print the ballots. Is that the issue?
Printing ballots is a big issue.
Yeah.
I think they say that's, you know, a printing ballots, making sure that they're translated into every language. Postage. You would want to include return postage on these. That costs more money. A lot of states need a lot of additional equipment, optical scanners and the like, to be sure that they can process this. A lot of states are built for having, you know, a low percentage of absentee ballots, you know, maybe 10 or 15% in some states. If you up that to 85, 90, or 100% of the vote, they're not ready for that. So they need more equipment and the like. So there are laws that have to be passed. You know, in some of these states, you know, right now you can do some kind of mail-in voting in every state, but there's still a third of our states in which you need specific excuses to cast an absentee ballot, and believe it or not, a pandemic is not one of them. So there's a lot that, you know, still has to be done.
So, looking forward to the next few months, I mean, what do you think has been gone right thus far in our politics, given the virus, and what's gone wrong?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I think that this has really exposed the need for us to modernize our elections. I think so much of this, you know, as we look forward, we have an election in 200 days, and we are not prepared to conduct democracy during a pandemic. And it's easy to say, well, who could have imagined? But if we had a more robust vote-by-mail operation set up that made voting easier, you know, something many states do and that many countries around the world have already figured out, we would be in a better position right now. And, you know, frankly, I think that our politics right now have been pushed to extremes and sort of towards the base of both parties, but especially in the direction of the Republican base in many states. And what we're seeing, you know, is you have a president who I would argue has been behaving in office as if he is the president of red state America and of his base, as opposed to the entire country, and has been thinking about his path to reelection as being kind of the exact same path that he, the same inside straight that he was able to the poll in 2016. And this was a president that did not want to face up to the real risks of this virus and kind of plan for it, because it seemed it would hurt his reelection. And you have kind of an anti-science wing of that party that, and an anti-news media wing, and they were kind of very happy to sort of call this a hoax manufactured by fake news media, and a certain percentage of the country was inclined to agree.
I'll just give you some numbers on that, because I actually polled on this last week. I mean, we have 30% who think that it's been exaggerated, and we polled on this 2.5 weeks ago. So 30% of the country thought it was exaggerated to hurt President Trump, and that was the question we asked. And and the people most likely to believe that are people who really like Trump and pay attention to the news. So if they're getting that message, and they're inclined to believe what Trump says, then they're going to buy that. And then we don't have very good causal evidence yet, because we're in the middle of a pandemic, but it looks like those same people are the ones who are least likely to, you know, wash their hands, social distance, you know, and take appropriate measures. So, you know, there's a real danger there when you have people spreading these conspiracy theories out there. So let me ask you this. So what can we do to get better candidates? I mean, let's say that we had an amazing, you know, democracy where the procedures were just, you know, wonderful. We could still wind up with terrible candidates. I mean, Trump might still get elected, even if we had better methods of voting. So how can we, you know, have better people?
I think that there's a little bit of chicken and egg here, I guess, right? I mean, I think we have I think it's very much interconnected. When you look at, and so I hesitate to make another structural suggestion, but I love ranked choice voting, especially in party primaries. I mean, Democrats had 25 different candidates this year, and they sort of forced it down really quickly to 4 or 5. And then, before most folks voted, kind of forced it down to 2. And everybody kind of voted based on electability or these kind of, you know, strange notions that it's really hard to quantify. If you could put your candidates in order, you would end up with, you know, a better outcome, and you'd have better candidates. We end up with, 2016, you had the two most unpopular major party nominees of their party ever. Trump emerges, again, as kind of a plurality winner. He was always winning 35-40% in these primaries. Most Republicans wanted someone else all the way to the end. If you had been able to do kind of an instant runoff, you would get a better candidate, and you would end up with a stronger nominee, you know, a less extreme nominee. And I think that this is the same thing in state legislatures, for Congress. In Georgia, more than 80% of state legislative elections go uncontested because people look at those races and they say, I can't win because of the districts. So, of course, you're going to get lousy candidates. You would get better candidates if people thought that there was a chance that they could win. I mean, 2016, North Carolina and Wisconsin, 50% of all state legislative races, completely uncontested. People looked at these local races and said, I don't have a chance of winning here, so why bother wasting my time and my money? We would get better races and better candidates, and then candidates we were all, I think, a little bit prouder of if we fixed our systems.
Should people have lower expectations in terms of what they're going to get from politics? I mean, it seems to me that there's so many people who want our government to do all sorts of stuff, you know, whether it's address social and moral issues or economic issues and whatnot. It seems like the demands that people have are very high. And they often go in radically different directions. I mean, should people just want less?
We're certainly getting less.
I would like to expect more competence, even if I don't get, you know, massive legislation that does what I want it to do.
I think we don't have any right to everything we want out of politics, but I think we do have a right to hope that a majority of citizens can move their government in the direction that they want it to go. And that seems like a basic enough principle, and we don't have that. And I think we have to find a way to get ourselves back there, or else it's really easy just to lose faith in this altogether, and then imagine the kinds of politics we would get if everybody kind of throws their hands in the air and says, there's nothing I can do here, maybe voting doesn't matter after all. I think that's just as big of a danger.
I mean, one thing I think that the coronavirus has exposed is that, you know, we can vote for people on our team and we can vote for people who tell us the things we want to hear, but competence is a very different thing. And that seems
managerial
like something that,
competence, yeah.
Yeah, managerial competence seems like something we don't really care about.
We've destroyed expertise. We've destroyed science. We've destroyed managerial competence. Yeah, there's our faith in the news media, our faith in science, in experts has all deteriorated. You know, our faith in institutions and their ability to competently do the right thing. And a lot of that is fair. A lot of our institutions have failed. The question now is, how do we improve them, and how do we survive, a virus that really needs that kind of competence and authority and scientific credibility?
Yeah, I have to wonder, how can we make primaries more about picking competent people? Or is there some mechanism that parties can have where they, you know, if you're going to run under their banner, you have to have some minimum level of experience before you can run under the party label.
Yeah. I mean, Jay Inslee, you know? I mean, Jay Inslee is the Washington governor, by all accounts, appears to be doing I'm not here in Massachusetts, I'm at 3,000 miles away, but, I mean, it appears he's doing a fairly competent job of leading his state through this crisis, that he kind of addressed it forthrightly and at the beginning. And he was in this mix of Democratic candidates, and he was one of the first to, you know, drop out.
Yeah, he did just about as good as Marianne Williamson, who I would say probably is not qualified to run.
I would say probably not is, a generous way of looking at the experience of Marianne Williamson.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, are there anti-democratic things that need to be done to make sure that we have better, you know, managerial competence? I mean, should parties be in the business of saying, all right, a spiritual healer is not going to be someone that we're going to allow to run in our primary?
Yeah, you know, I would have no problem with that. You know, she does not have, you know, the authority or the credibility to be on that stage. I do think if people were able to vote not only for one person, but to kind of put the field in order and to kind of use an instant runoff, you would see a different kind of voting. And I'm not sure you would always see the most competent candidate emerge, but I do think it would get some of those crackpots off the stage. And it would push us a little more back towards consensus, not a centrism per se, but that we would be able to settle on the person who more of us agreed on rather than just the most passionate 30%. And there's that passionate 30% in the Republican Party, and there's that passionate 30% in the Democratic Party. And then there's everybody else who, you know, isn't looking at it through quite those same, you know, fevered lenses, hoping for somebody who can step up and lead and solve some problems.
So if there was one thing that you think needs to happen between now and November, what's that one thing, that procedural issue that sort of needs to be clarified in the run-up to the next election?
A dramatic expansion of vote by mail, beginning with no excuse absentee voting for every American.
Okay. I mean, and that's probably something that's, you know, I would say that's something that's doable. I mean, everyone knows how to do it. It's just a question of enlarging the capacity, you think, right?
Congress could do it simply by passing a law that, you know, Congress has the ability to mandate that constitutionally. They could pass a law requiring all 50 states to do no excuse absentee. And let's start there. It has to be enacted carefully and thoughtfully, but there's a way to do it so that people don't feel like they're risking their health in order to exercise their right to vote.
Wow. You know, I was just going to say, too, money has a big influence on it. The amount of money that a candidate makes and brings in, you have to have so much support financially. And so candidates like Inslee couldn't go any further because he didn't have the funds.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I mean, and Citizens United hasn't done us any favors. They're kind of giving, you know, wealthy Americans the ability to kind of pour billions of unregulated dark cash into campaigns without any transparency at all. You know, on the other hand, the internet, I suppose, in some ways, has kind of democratized, you know, small donors and, you know, made it possible for some folks to run those races. But, you know, again, it tends to be the kind of the candidates of the extreme, of the passionate extreme that collect those, you know, small dollar donations. It's not Inslee as someone offering something as unsexy and important as, you know, managerial competence. We need a way to, you know, raise money for managerial competence at a small dollar level, and perhaps a virus, sadly enough, will be the thing that pushes us towards these reforms. I don't think much is going to look the same on the other side of this, and perhaps our voting systems will be among those changes.
So you think the election will go on as planned with the virus?
I don't know. I think that's the kind of question that should be keeping us up at night. I don't see us making the plans we need to make quickly enough to head this off. And I worry very much that as we head towards September, October, and if these plans are not in place, it's going to be just as hard to conduct a general election in November as it is to conduct a primary in Ohio and Wisconsin now. And then what happens? I mean, Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution gives the ability to appoint electoral college electors to state legislatures. Are we heading towards that in November and December? And in that case, you're going to have gerrymandered legislatures in many of these swing states. that already do a poor job of reflecting the political opinions of those states in charge of picking electors. So I think that's something that we ought to be doing all we can to avoid.
Well, on that happy note, we will wrap up.
And now you understand that dark cloud that I thought I had over my head on that show.
Yeah, just everybody, we do these shows during the virus just to make sure that people feel happy. we're here to cheer you
There's
up.
There's a lot of hope and optimism in this book. There really is.
Well, that's a good thing. Now, do you have a website or something people can go to feel better?
Yeah, you know, I'm Dave Daly 3 on Twitter. You can find the book on Amazon or your local bookstores nearby. You know, I don't have a website collecting all this stuff, but you can find both books out there, and your local bookstores certainly need the support right now.
Fantastic.
And we all have lots of time to read.
Yeah. Yeah, and we'll have your book up on our website as well, so people listening can pick up the book. And the book is called Unrigged: How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. And our guest has been the author, David Daly. Thank you for being on the show.
A pleasure. Thanks, guys.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.